for it. I will not watch the legacy of my children be destroyed.
Water
is life!
Water
is life!
Climate!
Justice!
Speaking more about misnomers, they're not residents, they're inmates. They're not neighborhoods, they're cell blocks. They're not family residential centers, they are jails.
Historically, it has already been proven that hiring more police officers, militarizing our community, does not combat crime, nor does it decrease crime.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Everam. For going on 3 years now, On the Ground has been your D.C.-based, volunteer-run news show covering social justice activism in the streets and in the suites of power. Well, as President Trump's overturned executive order banning immigration from seven Muslim-majority countries continues to make headlines, lawyers here in D.C. and around the country are defending asylum seekers from our own hemisphere, from Central and South America. Today, we'll be speaking with attorneys about controversial family detention centers and the practice of holding families of asylum seekers, including children, in what amounts to a prison. And did you know that these facilities also exist in our own region? All that is coming up later in the show, but first, our weekend review and headlines, starting, as we frequently do, with the prolific author and activist Professor Gerald Horn, whose most recent book is Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary. Well, Gerald, we've had quite a week here in D.C., including the shocking confirmation of the billionaire Betsy DeVos to head the Department of Education, and the even more shocking confirmation of Alabama Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions as the new U.S. Attorney General. So I don't know, where do we start? What do you think?
Well, let's start with Jeff Sessions. This has been a disaster, not only for the nation, but I would say particularly for the civil rights community. That is to say, when you have an heir to Jim Crow and the Confederacy, like Jeff Sessions, appointing to be the chief law enforcement officer of the United States of America, it sends a very chilling signal that the strategy of the civil rights community, which has relied upon the courts and relied upon a liberal wing of the U.S. ruling elite, has basically hit the wall. It seems to me that the civil rights community needs to go back to the drawing board. But perhaps even more ominous is his replacement, Luther Strange. That is to say, the Attorney General of the state of Alabama will be taking Jeff Sessions' place in Washington. Donald Trump has talked about draining the swamp. Well, Mr. Strange is a swamp monster. He has been a lobbyist for energy interests. And in fact, he's now implicated in a scandal back home in Alabama, because recall that Governor Bentley of Alabama got caught up in a sex scandal. And Mr. Strange, as the attorney general, said that he would investigate this scandal, and he called off the legislature from investigating the scandal. And now, in response, he has been awarded a Senate seat. This stinks to high heaven.
Well, other things happening this week, of course, the silencing of Elizabeth Warren as she read a letter written by Coretta Scott King, wife of course, slain human rights leader, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. And so this ominous tone that you're talking about in terms of Sessions seems to be permeating throughout the Congress, even, and even in terms of them confirming him, but then also silencing Senator Warren as she read Coretta Scott King's letter.
Well, this is part of a very disturbing pattern that's emerging in Washington since the inauguration of Donald J. Trump. That is to say, the silencing of dissent. It's not only the silencing of dissent in terms of what you may see in the streets, in terms of how protesters are subjected to roughhouse tactics, and manhandled, but it's even reached the chambers of the U.S. Senate, where Senator Elizabeth Warren was reprimanded and silenced for reading a letter from Coretta Scott King. This does not bode well for the immediate future.
I also know that you keep a close eye on what is happening kind of outside of our borders. What is some of the, I guess, little known news for this week as we are consumed here in D.C. with what's happening domestically, what's happening outside of our borders?
Well, there's an inside-outside angle. That is to say that not receiving sufficient attention from the press is Donald J. Trump's South African connection. That is to say that one of his chief advisors in Washington is South African-born Joel Pollack, who has the inside track in being appointed as Trump's ambassador to South Africa. Now, Mr. Pollack not only has South African roots, he was a top advisor to the major pro-neo-apartheid party in South Africa, the Democratic Alliance. And if he is posted to Pretoria, this will send a very dangerous signal to progressive forces in South Africa. And I would maintain it would send a dangerous signal to progressive forces throughout the entire African continent that the U.S. ambassador has very close connections to neo-apartheid forces and has control over U.S. intelligence services in Africa's most powerful country. And then there's Elon Musk, who is also South African-born, a billionaire, who, of course, is based in California. Recall that one of the reasons that he's a billionaire is that he receives enormous subsidies from the U.S. government. And perhaps not surprisingly, he's emerged as one of Donald J. Trump's go-to advisors with regard to the business and corporate community. This South African connection certainly deserves more investigation.
Okay, well, I know we will definitely check back with you as the weeks go on and more things continue to happen and more appointments occur and the news continues to roll out here from D.C. I've been speaking with Professor Gerald Horn, frequent contributor across the Pacifica Network, whose most recent book is Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary. Thank you, Gerald.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, this week, action here in D.C. has been happening in the streets as well as at the White House and on Capitol Hill. On Wednesday, water protectors gathered outside the White House to demonstrate against the Dakota Access Pipeline. That same day, the Army Corps of Engineers reversed a previous decision and granted an easement for the corporation Energy Transfer Partners to continue to drill in North Dakota on disputed land and beneath the Missouri River. Protesters say that the pipeline project endangers drinking water for millions of people and violates land and treaty rights of Native Americans. An indigenous water protector, Linda Black Elk, and the Reverend Lennox Yearwood addressed the crowd.
Now, I am angry and appalled that this easement has been granted and that they are taking away the safety of my children. This is cultural genocide, and I will not stand for it. I will not stand for it. I will not watch the legacy of my children be destroyed.
And let me be clear to all Americans, those who are in the White House right now are domestic enemies right now. Be very clear. This is not about Republican or Democrat. This is about humanity. We, today, the people, the true people, we rise up and we say no.
The pipeline was stopped by former U.S. President Barack Obama so that an environmental review could be completed, but that review was scrapped by President Trump last month. This week, there was also an expansion of court challenges, national protests, as well as expansion of a campaign for divestment from banks that are funding the pipeline. Seattle announced that it would not renew its contract with Wells Fargo, a lender to the pipeline project. Seattle's business was worth $3 billion in annual cash flow to Wells Fargo. Thousands of veterans also pledged to return to Standing Rock to protect the peaceful protesters there who have been shot with rubber bullets, hosed in sub-freezing temperatures, attacked by dogs, and subjected to police brutality and arrest. More than 700 peaceful protesters and journalists have been arrested. In Black Lives Matter news, activists voiced their opposition to a plan here in D.C. to spend $64 million to expand the city's police department, as opposed to investing those funds in human needs such as the city's housing crisis. Chantel James has more.
One day before the D.C. Council was due to vote on a bill that would dispatch 4,200 additional police officers on the streets of D.C., more than 200 protesters came out to raise their voices at a protest organized by Black Lives Matter D.C. and the Stop Terror Project D.C. Concerned that a greater police presence will create more problems than it solves, and that money would be of greater benefit to black communities if it was used to, quote, fund black futures, end quote, as some of the signs protesters held read. The protest was held at the John A. Wilson Building in downtown D.C., right across the street from Freedom Plaza. As council members came out of the building, protesters chanted, vote no to them, and the council members seemed to take this into consideration. To conclude the protest, those gathered were led in a vibrant rendition of the chant, I believe that we will win. Speakers included Eugene Puryear and April Goggins of the Black Lives Matter movement and Beverly Smith of the Coalition of Concerned Mothers, whose son Alonzo was killed by police officers in November 2015. Here, Ms. Smith praises the NEAR Act and voices community opposition to the proposed legislation.
I was really appalled to find out that the city wants to hire 4,200 more police officers. Historically, it has already been proven that hiring more police officers, militarizing our community, does not combat crime, nor does it decrease crime. What is needed in our community is to increase the funds in the already approved NEAR Act. What I like about the NEAR Act is that it gets to the causes, the root causes of crime in the community. Police officers, they come in as a reaction.
To keep up with Black Lives Matter, follow them at DMV Black Lives. From downtown Washington, D.C., this is Chantal James for On the Ground.
The opposed legislation, the Police Officer Recruitment and Retention Emergency Act of 2017, failed to pass the D.C. Council on Tuesday. Other actions this week, both the Palestine Center and the D.C. Public Library held programs exploring both Trump's foreign policy on Palestine and the Middle East and Islamophobia. A group called Americans for Transit held a transit rider meeting to oppose proposed fare increases and service cuts on Metro public transportation. And on Thursday night, Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin, the parents of slain teenager Trayvon Martin, spoke in D.C. in support of their new book, Rest in Power. Also in culture and media, for Black History Month, the Baltimore Black Memorabilia and Collectible Show is being held tomorrow, Saturday, February 11th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland, African American History and Culture in downtown Baltimore. Black memorabilia and collectibles for sale will include artifacts, books, autographs, stamps, fine art, paintings, prints, dolls, postcards, movie memorabilia, and so much more. There will be a special educational exhibit on slavery and artifacts, Jim Crow memorabilia, Negro League baseball, Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X, Dorothy Dandridge, and more. For more information, call 301-649-1915 or visit johnsonshows.com. You can also visit the museum's website, lewismuseum.org. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, asylum seekers from the Americas and families with children being imprisoned, even here in our own region. Stay with us.
They call it a pipeline, but those on the front lines know that black snake was sent for us to grow, to shed the skin our ancestors pray, of wounds old and calloused, so that we may stay, so that we may unite, unity our tool. No weapons are found in this court of rule. Men becoming ki'ai, steadfast in their guard, protecting women's hearts as their song become roots, roots to cast out healing for all sentient beings, to honor sacred mother, heart forward we heal. The salmon will run, the mauna will breathe, the rivers will flow. The rainbow is here, and prophecy tells us all generations will hear.
Nations and our people that have been living here for thousands of years.
Stand up.
We've been fighting for our freedom since the Nina and the Pinta and the Santa Maria.
Stand up.
Like Geronimo, Sitting Bull, Red Cloud, Crazy Horse, Leonard Peltier.
Stand up.
Now they poisoning the waters for our sons and our daughters, so we on the frontier.
We won.
One nation, one cause, one people, one tribe. Now it's us against the pipeline. Get on your feet for Standing Rock, and we'll show you how strong we could be when we unify.
To all my native people, recognize yourself, keep your head up. To all my tribal people, recognize yourself, keep your head up.
Planet Earth, it's been spinning, we've been living and dying, but giving birth the first of many nations, celebrating them days when all that got made came after what
God made.
These days we cater to these internet memes, internet streams, it seems them streams aren't clean. We need the whole story seen, we're hassling before water has gasoline in it. Malcolm X moment, Martin Luther King with a dream and war boning, wounded knee plus Alcatraz, doggone it. This is for the rock, with prayers we stand on it.
Oh yeah, we playing on it, the earth we camp on it. In a sweat lodge singing our songs with grandfathers. Heat rocks all in the spot, we splash on them with a beatbox from my boy B Jam on it. Said a prayer for the black snake killers. Train on the front lines, they you're the realest. Stand for your people, stand for your family. Stand with Standing Rock, stand for humanity.
It takes a group of people who actually care about, you know, Mother Earth and life and water being sacred and the land being sacred, to say we stand up.
To all my native people, recognize yourself, keep your head up. To all my tribal people, recognize yourself, keep your head up.
Mini Wachoni, water is life.
Mini Wachoni,
water is life.
Water is life.
Water is life.
Water is life.
I stand
with Standing Rock.
I stand with Standing Rock.
I stand with Standing Rock.
Stand up.
Stand up.
Stand up.
Stand up.
I stand with Standing Rock. Stand up.
To all my native people,
woke up the giant, we won't go quiet.
To all my tribal people,
don't mistake our peace as we stand defiant.
To all my native people,
it's the calm before the storm and I can hear it coming.
To all my tribal people,
I'm ready for the battle when we ain't running.
Stand up, stand up, stand up, stand up. Stand up, stand up, stand up, stand up.
History is on a sad repeat. Is it liberty or we just acting free? As our land depletes from these hands of greed. See, fate is found, how we face the hounds. Take a vow for these sacred grounds. Make a sound that'll shake them out. Say aloud, what can save us now?
That was Stand Up, Standing Rock, featuring Taboo. This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Averam. Well, as President Trump's overturned executive order banning immigration from 7 Muslim-majority countries continues to wind its way through the courts, Lawyers here in D.C. and around the country continue to take up the cause of asylum seekers from our own hemisphere, from Central and South America. Today we'll be speaking with attorneys about controversial family detention centers and the practice of holding families of asylum seekers, including children, in what amounts to a prison. And these facilities exist in our own region. With me today to unpack this urgent issue are three attorneys advocating for asylum seekers. Joining me in studio is Lindsay Harris, Assistant Professor of Law for Immigration and Human Rights for the Immigration and Human Rights Clinic, the University of District of Columbia David A. Clark School of Law. Welcome, Lindsay. Joining me via Skype is Katie Shepherd, former managing attorney of the CARA Project and the current legal fellow at the American Immigration Council. Good morning, Katie.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on this morning.
And Andrea Meza, Equal Justice Works Fellow and Staff Attorney for Racist San Antonio, Texas. Welcome.
Good morning.
Welcome all of you to On the Ground. And I apologize for a little technical problems we're having here, but we're trying to work it out. This is public radio, live radio, and we're all doing our best today, right? So the current focus on the Muslim ban puts the emphasis on asylum seekers from the Middle East. But as many of you described in a recent symposium you had at UDC, there's also a picture for asylum seekers from our own hemisphere. So I want to, Lindsay, for you to talk a little bit about that. And are we talking about more asylum seekers actually coming from our own borders here as opposed to the Muslim world?
Right, that's right. And again, thank you for having me. I'll just say that I teach at UDC in the District of Columbia, where our mission is social justice. So being a part of this show is really an honor as we strategize and come together as voices and actors of resistance. But when we think about asylum seekers, I'll just explain there's two ways of seeking asylum. The first is people who are arriving at our border and expressing a fear of return. They go through what is called a credible fear interview. And if you look at the numbers of folks coming that way, predominantly we're seeing people from what we call the Northern Triangle in Central America, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and then often from Mexico, and the smallest numbers, you know, in the top five is from India. The other way to apply for asylum is for people who've already made it within our borders, often on a student visa or a tourist visa. Something happens and they're unable to return home because they're afraid. And those asylum seekers are from different regions in the world. For example, in September 2016, the highest number of receipts were from Venezuela, China, and Mexico, and then again, the Central American region. So we're really seeing a lot of asylum seekers come from Central America and not really from the Middle East as much. You know, back in September, Syria, Iraq weren't even in the top 10 for asylum applications received in this country.
Wow. Now, yesterday, this is kind of intersecting with some kind of breaking news. Yesterday, we understand that there were ICE raids in many parts of the country. And I just heard this morning the case of a Mexican woman who lived here for 20 years, who had gone in for her regular check-in with immigration, and she was placed in, I guess, detention and then deported right away. So I'm wondering if you see in your work any impact from this apparent change from the Trump administration impacting the work that you're doing. And I guess I should go to Andrea to ask Andrea and Katie to both answer that.
Sure. This is Andrea. Thank you again for including us on this. For context, I work out of the San Antonio Office of RAICES. We're a Texas-based immigration legal services nonprofit, and I help coordinate our volunteer program at the Carnes Family Detention Center. So it's a immigration prison, basically, that houses mothers and children. And so what we've seen with the recent changes with what ICE calls interior enforcement, but are raids to the community, is that more people are being put into these detention centers who have been here in the United States and then are getting picked up and placed in the detention centers on their way out. And it's made our work different in the fact that these are really challenging cases and really urgent cases where we have to file motions and get in paperwork to try to prevent deportation as soon as possible. So that's what we have seen in terms of the Carnes work.
And I'm also along the same line. I want to explain to our listeners, you know, what it means to be an asylum seeker, what makes these people asylum seekers as opposed to people just wanting to come here, and the kinds of stories that you hear from the women and children in particular, and I guess the role of the United States in creating the conditions where they're coming from. Katie or Andrea, please.
Well, the families that we see in detention, the ones from Central America, and I will say we have seen an increase in families coming who are Haitian and also Cuban who have now been placed in detention. But most of the families, as Lindsay mentioned, are from those Northern Triangle countries. And they're coming because of instability in their country, mostly fueled by gang violence. And a lot of these gangs originated in the United States and then were sent back to Central America when people were deported because of really harsh deportation policies to deport criminals. We sent them back to Central America, and after decades of civil war, these states weren't equipped to handle the influx of gang members into their society, and we sort of sent them into a vacuum of the state's ability to deal with this situation, and the gangs have flourished in that. And in a lot of countries, especially in El Salvador, they've really sort of taken over almost state control, imposing taxes and laws, essentially, in the communities that they control. And so people are getting pushed out of their countries, literally fleeing for their lives. And they come to the United States because they have family here. They know people here. And the reason they have family here is because people came fleeing those civil wars that the United States did play a part in creating by pushing for instability in some of these countries. So it's a really long and ongoing process of connection and instability that's sort of been fueled by lots of actions the United States has taken. And unfortunately, we are treating these people as folks who are just coming to migrate. They just want to come here to get a job, and that is not the case at all. The most common refrain I hear with the women that we work with is that they never would have left their country if it weren't for their lives or their children's lives being at risk.
Katie, so kind of tying in with the news today, when we talk about detention centers, are they holding primarily, you know, these recent arrivals, people who are seeking asylum, or some of the undocumented people picked up by immigration, like the people being picked up in these raids? Are these people also being put into these detention facilities?
Hi, everyone. I'm actually calling from Dilley, Texas today. I'm down here for the week assisting the team on the ground. So thank you for inviting me this morning. I'm very happy to be on the call. I would say that the vast majority of the mothers and their children who are being detained in the jail here in Dilley are recent arrivals to the United States. It's very rare that a family is picked up stateside and then taken into custody and transferred to the detention center here. As Andrea mentioned a little while ago, what the government calls interior enforcement actions, what most people call in the community a raid, that would be when someone would be picked up potentially stateside and brought to the detention center. We saw raids last January and again in May and June, where groups of Central American families were picked up and brought to the detention center. But we found that 100% of these cases that we represented had meritorious claims for relief, which is to say they had strong claims for asylum. So we anticipate this potentially happening again in the future, but we'll be ready to respond to whatever the government throws at us.
What are some of the, Katie, what are some of the situations that people are fleeing in terms of their own personal safety? What kinds of stories are you hearing from people seeking asylum?
I'm sure that Andrea could answer this at length also, but yesterday I spoke with a young woman from Guatemala. She had been raped several times at the age of 10. She tried to relocate within the country, was unable to do so. Various transnational criminal organizations, what we call gangs, have subjected her to a long campaign of violence, death threats, and rape threats, culminating with a threat against her 2-year-old daughter for rape, which ultimately led her to flee in January and come to the United States asking for asylum and asking for protection from the United States government. So that would be one example.
Andrea, did you want to add?
I think that that's unfortunately pretty representative of what we see. I think it's also important for us to always remember to seek out the voices of these women too, so that they can share their stories and advocate for themselves. Because I think that we can talk about the work that we do a lot, but without hearing from the community and why they're coming, it's a bit hollow sometimes. But unfortunately, what Katie talked about here is really representative. Women are fleeing because they have been raped, because of the threat of rape. A woman that I spoke to whose story sticks in my head was that she was robbed by the gang several times, and the last time that she was robbed in her home, two gang members came and raped her one after the other at gunpoint. So these are really common things that we're hearing, and this is why people are immediately leaving their homes and leaving their lives and coming to the United States asking us to help them.
You know, we actually will like to follow up on a future show, and what we'll have to do is coordinate the translation and everything. It's a little challenging for us today, but we definitely will follow up with another show when we can have the translation set up and talk to as many people as we can. So thank you. Thank you so much for that. And I think they're going to actually go to a little break right now. And when we come back, I'm going to continue my conversation on this urgent issue, and we'll be right back.
I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door. Nothing. Open up the door. I'll get it myself. I don't give me integration. Give me true communication. I don't give me sorrow. I want equal opportunity to live tomorrow. Give me schools and give me better books so I can read about myself and gain my truer looks. I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door, I'll get it myself. Do you hear me now, now? I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door, I'll get it myself. Some of us try as hard as we can. We don't want no sympathy, we just wanna be a man. I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door, I'll get it myself. You hear me? I don't want nobody giving me nothing. Open up the door, I'll get it myself. We got talents we can use on our side of town. Let's get our heads together and build it up from the ground. When some of us make money, we forget about our people. Come on.
That was James Brown, I Don't Want Nobody to Give Me Nothing. And this is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Avarim, and I'm in conversation with Lindsay Harris, Katie Shepherd, and Andrea Meza about family detention. And one of the things that I learned from watching the proceedings of your symposium, Lindsay, is that, you know, people may think of detention facilities about being, you know, in border states, but we actually have some detention facilities in our own region, I guess. So tell me a little bit about where these facilities are, you know, how many people are being held, and especially about facilities here in the Mid-Atlantic.
Sure. So our closest family detention center where families, moms, and kids are being held is actually in Berks County, Pennsylvania, which is only about a 2.5-hour drive away from here. And there are actually kids and moms who've been held at that detention center, which is a former nursing home, for more than a year and a half at this point. But we have a number of detention centers in the kind of D.C., Mid-Atlantic region. The largest is in Farmville, Virginia, which is a few hours away from here. Right now, there's around 600 people there, but we are expecting, with the raids, which began in this region this week and yesterday, really, for the population to go up to 1,500. There are a few other smaller jails where there are agreements with the government to hold immigrants in detention. There's one in Worcester County, one in Frederick County, Maryland, Howard County, Maryland. Those are around, you know, 50 to 200 men and women held there. And we do see them transferring asylum seekers from the border, too. One thing to note about detention centers is they usually aren't right next to a city, next to a metropolitan center. One of the reasons for that, we believe, is that the government makes it more difficult for detained immigrants to access counsel. So they'll locate a detention center out in Farmville, Virginia, for example, where there aren't a whole ton of attorneys there ready to provide legal representation.
Okay. And are people, I guess, students or attorneys here actively involved in working with those people detained nearby?
Yeah, the local organization who are really engaged in this is the Capital Area Immigrant Rights Coalition, CARE Coalition, and they're actually located very close to where we're speaking today. They're on K Street. And they do regular outreach and representation in all of the regional detention centers. They send out staff, they take volunteers and students every day of the week. They were also instrumental in providing a presence at Dulles and at Reagan Airport when we saw, you know, the effects of the ban and the executive orders going into effect last week. So, yeah, the lawyers are engaged in representing detained immigrants. We're going to see more and more detained immigrants, unfortunately, picked up, people needing help, and we'll be there and ready to fight for them.
You know, I also want to explore the issue of the role of the private prison industry. I know from some coverage we did last year that President Obama had ended a part of the relationship between the federal government and the private prison industry. But this whole issue of immigration and these detention facilities seem to be exempted from that. And I know Rashad Robinson at Color of Change, he was part of a protest, an action downtown to draw attention to this. So give us an update on that. What is the role of the private prison industry, Katie, and then Lindsay?
Hi, sure. So it goes without saying, I think, that the role of the private prison industry, their bottom line is to make money. And I think if you look at the family detention context, that becomes very, very apparent when we have an over 90% approval rate for the mothers and children coming through Dilley and Carnes. They get 90% of them get positive decisions after their credible fear interviews. So when you know that, and then they are released between 2 and 4 weeks later, and it's roughly over $260 per family member per day, then that means it's costing the American taxpayers, U.S. taxpayers, almost $1,000 a day for a family of three. So when you look at the numbers, it's very clear to me, and I'm sure most of your listeners out there, that the bottom line is to make money. Something we should also note that, you know, before we had this reintroduction of mass incarceration of asylum seekers starting in 2014, with Artesia, Dilly, and Carnes. Most family members were released at the border with notices to appear, so they were not cycled through the CFI process and subjected to detention. So, you know, there are many alternatives to detaining individuals, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later. But I would say bottom line is making money.
Well, we're going to be running out of time soon, so I don't want to save a subject for later. Why don't we go right into that? A lot of people listening to the program will say, well, what is the alternative? If we don't have people in detention, where are they going to go? What are they going to do? So why don't we talk about some of the alternatives that are acceptable for families and children?
Sure, I can jump in on that. This is Lindsay. So 95% of these families coming from Central America actually do have a place to go here in the U.S. They have family, friends, connections that they can be released. They can be released from detention and to pursue their asylum claim outside of detention, which is how it did work prior to 2014, as Katie said. Another alternative to detention is kind of supervision or case management for these families. A lot of the families really need help assisting, you know, assisting them getting their kids into school. This ties back actually to the question of the private prison corporations. We have GEO Corporation at Carnes and the Corrections Corporation of America.
And their stock went through the roof after Trump was elected.
Absolutely.
Their stock went up.
Absolutely. But we've also seen them getting involved in alternatives to detention. So GEO, for example, started a subsidiary called GEO Cares. It's hard for me to even say that name. But they got a big contract with the government under Obama to provide case management to these families as an alternative to detaining them. They also own their subsidiary is BI Corporation, who are the corporation who put ankle monitors, or what our clients call grietas.
One second, I hear a multitasking attorney on the line. I need her to stop typing. We can hear you.
It's really busy down in those detention centers.
I know. Just for a few more minutes, you can go back to your typing. Go ahead.
Yeah, so BI Corporation is the entity that puts ankle monitors, or shackles, really, grietes, as the women call them in Spanish, on these women. And these monitors are on them at all times, cause some pain, discomfort, obviously stigma associated with potentially people assuming you're a criminal if you're wearing an ankle monitor. We see the private prison corporations getting involved in all aspects of this process, immigration detention to release. It's a pretty scary environment right now.
And if I may, this is Andrea. I just want to add in that we all need to be aware that these private prison corporations have lobbyists who are making huge contributions to politicians who then, in turn, are the ones oftentimes putting in place a lot of these really restrictive immigration and criminal laws and policies. So this is all tied back, as Katie was saying, into the bottom line, into making money for them.
Yes, and I'm going to have to wrap up with my guests right now. I wanted to give you all, like, just if you want to just have some final words, anything that you didn't get to say that you think is important for us to know, Lindsay.
I think it's important to know how you can engage. So right now we're going to see raids rolling out, interior enforcement, as the government calls it. United We Dream is an organization that has a campaign called Here to Stay, and you can look that up on Twitter. You can actually text the words Here to Stay to 877-877, and they will let you know when raids are going on in your community, and you can physically show up just like you did at the march. And be there for our community. You can also look into getting involved with local organizations. The Aldea People's Justice Center supports our local detention center for families in Berks County, Pennsylvania. So it's aldeapjc.org is their website if you want to check them out. So continue to challenge, you know, these policies of detaining families, protecting asylum seekers in our immigrant communities. There's many ways to do that. So educate yourself and get involved.
And that will have to do it for us on the Ground, onthegroundshow.org. Thanks again to our guests today, Gerald Horn, Lindsay Harris, Katie Shepherd, and Andrea Mesa. Thanks to Chantel James, Liddy and Michael Byfield. Thanks to our engineer, Luke Stewart, and thank you for listening and donating. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows. Please don't forget to like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. I'm Esther Varm. On tomorrow, I'll be on hand at the Black Memorabilia and Collectible Show in Baltimore. And next Friday, the 17th, I'm emceeing the program Next Steps for Independent Politics, Stopping Neo-Fascism and Resisting Neoliberalism. And that'll be at the Public Welfare Foundation at 1200 U Street Northwest. The event is listed on Eventbrite. Raise your voice out there. Peace.
Sweet time. I'll give it right back to you. Oh, what did you say?